Hi, it's Nahani Rouse, here with another episode of Can We Talk? Before we start the show, I want to tell you about a new podcast that I think you'll enjoy called Thoughts and Prayers from the Shalom Hartman Institute. It's hosted by Jessica Fisher, and it's a moving exploration of Jewish prayer and why it matters in modern life. Each episode weaves together personal stories, ancient texts, and conversations with thinkers and rabbis like Yossi Klein Halevi, Tamar Alad Applebaum, Lauren Holzblatt, and Yehuda Kurtzer, wrestling with what it means to pray in our modern world. It's beautifully produced, deeply personal, and full of the kinds of questions that stay with you long after you've listened. If you're curious about spirituality, community, or what prayer means today, check out Thoughts and Prayers from the Shalom Hartman Institute, available wherever you get your podcasts. Now, on to the show. Welcome back to Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive, where gender, history, and Jewish culture meet. Just a few blocks from the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C., the Capitol Jewish Museum sits surrounded by downtown D.C.'s mix of modern office buildings and government agencies. I visited the museum a few months ago to see a special exhibit, LGBT Jews in the Federal City.
As far as we know, we are the first Jewish museum in the United States to do a major exhibit on LGBT Jewish history. We shouldn't be the first.
I toured the exhibit with Jonathan Edelman, the museum's collections curator.
The other thing that's very important for us is for everyone who comes to this museum to understand that this is Jewish history. This is not just an LGBT exhibit, it's a Jewish history exhibit.
And since it's a DC Jewish history exhibit, the history is not just local. In the nation's capital, local history and national history are woven together. Jewish leaders of the LGBTQ rights movement, politicians, writers, and artists have worked, lived, and created Jewish community here for decades. As curator Sarah Levitt says, being queer in the nation's capital is not new.
This is probably the most important thing to me about this whole exhibit, the idea that sexuality and gender have a history. I think a lot of times maybe people think there weren't different genders or different sexualities before their own consciousness of it. As a DC local history museum, I feel like that's our job to be part of that storytelling. I think another thing is how personal it is to people who do have a relationship with the story, who either are queer themselves or have kids who are LGBTQ, that it's meaningful to them to see those stories in a mainstream Jewish institution.
Sarah adds that Jewish institutions have not always been so inclusive when it comes to recognizing our community's diversity, and that correcting those missteps is itself a Jewish value.
I want to tell the story, not just that it's about Jewish people, but that we are telling it Jewishly, which to me means a lot of different things. One of the things it means is that there's some teshuva in there. There's some looking back at ourselves and thinking about how the Jewish community has responded poorly to various movements, including gay rights movements. I think that's really important to a Jewish museum, to really look critically at feelings of belonging and acceptance.
In this episode of Can We Talk, we step into the history of LGBTQ Jews in the nation's capital with Jonathan Edelman as our guide. Jonathan starts by talking about how the exhibit came to be. When he began at the museum as an intern in 2019, he started scouring its collection for material about LGBTQ life in D.C. For him, it was personal.
I grew up in Kansas City in, thankfully, a very welcoming home when I came out, but I did not see a lot of out Jewish people in various Jewish spaces that I grew up in. And so when I came to Washington after undergrad and saw out LGBT people in every Jewish space that I went to, I knew this felt different in a really positive way, and I wanted to dig into the archive to learn more about that community's history. And unfortunately, there was not a single thing that I could find in the collection. The museum had inherited the collection of the Jewish Historical Society of Greater Washington, and from 1960 to 2019, when I got there, it had not been a collecting priority.
So Jonathan made it a priority. He met with LGBTQ community members and began to collect photos, artifacts, papers, a tangible record of LGBTQ life in D.C.
You know, for me, as an LGBT Jewish person in my 30s, I really want this exhibit to teach other young LGBT people about our own story, about our history, about how much some of us are able to take for granted because of people who fought before us. But at the same time, we are now having to fight a lot of those fights again. And this history can be a roadmap for that. So I desperately want young queer people to understand how we got here. I also want LGBT elders to have their story honored. I can't tell you how many people whose homes I went to, who they kept everything, and it was clear they were just waiting for someone to ask.
We start in the third floor lobby. The exhibit takes up the entire floor, over 3,000 square feet of space, divided into rooms that are chronologically organized. Jonathan leads me over to the beginning, about as far back and non-local as you can get.
It was important for us to address the elephant in the room, which was Leviticus. So much pain for not only Jews, but other people who are LGBTQ and also of faith comes from the Bible being weaponized against their gender or sexuality. And so the first panel you see is on Judaism and sexuality. We start with Leviticus. We start with different interpretations of that one line in that one chapter.
Can you read it, please?
Yes. So the quote is from Leviticus chapter 18, and it's, "And with a man thou shalt not lie, as with woman, it is an abomination." And that is just one of several different translations of that verse.
Why did you decide to begin the exhibit with that?
We wanted joy in this exhibit, but we also had to acknowledge the pain and where that pain came from. And when we're doing an exhibit specifically on the intersection of Jewish and LGBT, we have to start with that. We look at how some Jewish institutions, how some rabbis, how some movements of the Jewish community have changed over time and how others have not. We both acknowledge the progression, but also the pain that very much still exists. And then we immediately dive into a timeline, because of equal importance to us was to debunk the myth that somehow gender and sexuality is something new. Our timeline goes back 415 years. The early period, we definitely ask more questions than we have answers to.
The earliest date on the timeline is 1610, when the first anti-sodomy law was passed in colonial Virginia. Then the timeline jumps to the late 1800s. Jonathan says the records of D.C. queer life that far back are spotty.
We don't have a lot because a lot was erased, either by people who did not want queer stories preserved or by the LGBTQ people themselves who are trying to protect themselves by not having trace, by not having evidence. And so we try and fill in gaps. Like, for example, we know that the locker rooms of the YMCA were a popular place in the late 1800s and early 1900s for gay men to meet up and interact with each other. We know that at the same time, there was a Jewish community center on 16th Street, a few blocks from the White House, that had a locker room where men would meet up. We don't have evidence in the same way that these men were meeting up for sexual experiences, but when we know it was happening down the street at the YMCA, we sort of ask, could it also have been happening there?
Then Jonathan shares a current statistic that I was surprised by.
Everyone thinks about New York and San Francisco as sort of the LGBT capitals of America. Washington has the highest per capita number of LGBT people in the United States.
That's according to the Williams Institute at UCLA.
But there's a history to this. So in the early 20th century, it was sort of less common for after graduation, if people went to college, to move in with a roommate in an apartment. You usually sort of got married and moved in with your opposite sex spouse, but not in Washington. People deferred sometimes marriage and came to Washington to work in the federal government. And so there were these young postgraduate people moving to Washington and needing a place to live. And so there were boarding houses.
Is this men and women too?
Yes. And usually the boarding houses were either completely separated by gender, but in the very least, the rooms were separated by gender. And so same-sex couples could live in these boarding houses as quote-unquote roommates and not be suspected. Mm-hmm. And so we know, we have records that gay people would move into these boarding houses so that they could live together. We also know that there were several what were called kosher boarding houses run by Jews with kosher food for religiously observant Jews, including Disson's, which is one that we include in the exhibition.
Can we look at that together, and you can describe what's on this picture?
Yes. So this is a photo of some of the residents, the young residents. They look like they look almost like teenagers, but they're likely in their early 20s on the front steps of Disson's boarding house in DuPont Circle. It's a group of maybe 10 or 12 young individuals on the front steps, dressed in sort of casual clothes, but you have a woman in the center in a suit jacket smoking a cigar, and you have some men who are sort of making some flamboyant gestures. We are not prescribing gayness onto them, but we are leaving you with that question.
And why was this a different situation in D.C. than in other cities? Like, why are people coming here and living in boarding houses and working before getting married?
Sure, because of all the federal jobs. So especially around the New Deal in World War II, there was a huge influx of especially a lot of young people because there was so much job opportunity. And the people would sort of delay and move here for those federal jobs, some civil, some military. But there was a large portion of it in Washington, D.C. And still today, you have lots of young people who move here to work in government.
The next part of the exhibit is about what's known as the Lavender Scare. Beginning in the 1950s, the government began scrutinizing federal workers' private lives and firing anyone suspected of being a homosexual. It was part moralistic grandstanding and part paranoia that gay people were a national security risk because they were vulnerable to blackmail. Frank Kameny was an astronomer with the U.S. Army Map Service. He was fired in 1965 for lewd and indecent acts.
What Frank Kameny and the people in 1965 who protested outside the White House said was, well, they can't blackmail us for homosexuality when we're admitting openly that we're homosexual. And so there was an effort sort of by the vice squad of the D.C. police, the FBI, to surveil people. And if they were caught at a bar that was known to have sort of a lot of same-sex people or cruising or anything like that, they could lose their federal job. And Frank Kameny spent his whole life, both through the Mattachine Society and other groups, fighting for civil protection for sexuality. And he ultimately lost his job and never got it back in his whole life. But he spent his whole life fighting.
Frank Kameny became one of the most prominent members of the gay rights movement and remained connected to the local Jewish community.
So we use the Lavender Scare section to talk about historically what happened, but in the months before the exhibit opened, in the section on military service, we had to add the executive order in January 2025 by our current president to ban transgender people from military service. So we had Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that fight is present again. And so another thing that the timeline does is show that rights weren't only gained, but they have been gained and lost up until this exhibit opened.
As the timeline moves into the second half of the 20th century, it's populated with both highs and lows in the history of gay rights. For example, in 1961, the Civil Service Commission put out a policy that homosexuality is incompatible with federal service. In the coming years, gay rights activists responded, taking cues from the civil rights movement.
They were able to adapt a lot of the successful fights for their own fight for their rights. 1965 was a really pivotal year. The Mattachine Society of Washington holds its first picket outside the White House. So everyone thinks of the Stonewall riots in 1969 in New York as the sort of kickoff of the modern gay rights movement. But 4 years earlier, the Mattachine Society of Washington composed of men and women who were wrongfully fired from their federal jobs for being accused of being homosexual, picketed openly outside the White House. It was a major step towards fighting for rights. Also in 1965, as you can see on the timeline, the Women of Reform Judaism became the first Jewish organization to call for the decriminalization of homosexuality. 1965 is very early for really any established Jewish institution to stand up for gay rights in this way. But the Women of the Reform Judaism were way, way, way ahead of a lot of other groups.
In the late 70s, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations passed a resolution supporting the civil rights of gay people. In 1980, the World Congress of Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Jews was founded. There are political buttons, photographs, an early edition of the Gay Blade, the longest continuously published LGBTQ paper in the United States.
We have a first edition of Evelyn Beck's Nice Jewish Girls, which was a really pivotal anthology for lesbian Jews that came out in 1982.
The paperback sits in a glass case. Nice Jewish Girls was the first collection of its kind and includes articles, stories, and poetry that address anti-Semitism and homophobia. It's also a joyful celebration of Jewish lesbian identity, featuring authors like Irina Klepfisch, Adrian Rich, and Melanie K. Kantrowitz. Next, we move into the section on the 80s and 90s, where the central theme is the AIDS crisis. The exhibit looks at both local and national Jewish and non-Jewish stories.
We, of course, talk about groups like Whitman Walker Clinic that were instrumental in working to save the lives of people diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. And we also talk about the Jewish community's both response and lack of response. Using materials we had in our archive, the Jewish Community Council, sort of an umbrella organization for the Jewish institutions and synagogues in the Washington area. We have their meeting minutes going back to the 1940s. And the first mention we were able to find, the first statement on AIDS from the DC's Jewish Community Council, didn't come until 1992. And of course, thousands had already died at that point. A lot of the Jewish institutions were slow to respond to the crisis. There was sort of this not wanting to acknowledge what was happening. And there were individuals in the community, usually those who either had been diagnosed themselves or lost loved ones, who were fighting to get the Jewish community to do more.
On one wall of the exhibit hangs a floor-to-ceiling block of the AIDS Memorial quilt, on loan from the National AIDS Memorial. This 12-foot block contains 5 panels out of nearly 50,000 that make up the quilt. This square has around 30 names on it, all of them employees at the Library of Congress who died of AIDS. One of them is David M. Green, a past president of Beit Mishpacha, DC's LGBTQ synagogue.
He left his job at the Library of Congress because he was so frustrated by the lack of response from the Jewish community to the AIDS crisis. And so he became this advocate and activist. He went to youth group conventions and he said, nice little Jewish boys and girls are also going through this and we need to do something about it. And for 2 years, he fought like hell to make sure that more Jewish institutions were doing more. Ultimately, in 1989, he died from AIDS-related complications, but not before really pushing the Jewish community in big ways. And so we picked this AIDS Memorial Quilt panel to honor his memory.
Can you describe what it looks like?
Each panel was designed to approximately be the size of a coffin. That was intentional. And people could do whatever they wanted pretty much on the panel. So this one has the dome of the Library of Congress, a sort of muted rainbow going over the dome. And then the names up until this point of members of the Library of Congress staff that had died from AIDS-related complications. There are probably 16 lines of names, and included among those lines is the Latin phrase "sine nomine," anonymous. Even in their death, these people had to remain anonymous because either they didn't want people to know, or oftentimes family was ashamed or didn't want to acknowledge that they died of AIDS.
The AIDS quilt is the largest piece of community art in the world. it was unveiled at the 1987 National March for Gay and Lesbian Rights. When it was laid out on the National Mall, it blanketed the ground from the Washington Monument all the way to the Capitol.
Here you have a big picture on the wall of, tell me what we're looking at.
Yeah, so there's a photograph, a large mural photograph from one of the marches on the National Mall of the delegation from Beit Mishpacha led.
March for what?
This was the March for Gay and Lesbian Rights. I believe it's from the 87 March. Two members of the congregation leading the delegation in the front of the picture are holding up a cloth banner that says Beit Mishpacha, the Gay and Lesbian Synagogue of Washington, D.C. And above that photograph, we have the original banner, which they used at gay pride parades for their booth in the 70s and 80s. There's great video footage from the Rainbow History Project, D.C.'s LGBT archive, of some of those early pride festivals in the 80s, and different groups would hand out pamphlets and also have things to give away. And in a hot, humid June day in Washington, D.C., there's video footage of Beit Mishpacha handing out slices of noodle kugel. and it's sort of dripping down onto this banner. Luckily, it's been cleaned up, but it's a just beautiful footage and a moment in this history.
Jonathan leads me over to a display case that contains minutes from a 1992 meeting of Beit Mishpacha.
It is two white pieces of paper with black type on it. Pretty unfascinating. We use it to because they talk about sort of a struggle for acceptance. Beit Mishpacha was blacklisted from becoming a member of the Jewish Community Council, that umbrella organization, for several years. They were founded in 1975, and it wasn't until the 1980s that they were finally, late 1980s, that they were finally let in. We use this artifact for, but the first week, an older lesbian couple came in who were early members of Beit Mishpacha, and they were looking at the meeting minutes, and at the very top it's the call to order, and then it lists everyone in the meeting. It says Al Munzer, Larry Neff, keeps going with all these names, and then it just says Rochelle. And this woman said, oh my God, I forgot that I only use my first name. And we said, well, why? She said, I was a federal employee, and if the meeting minutes were subpoenaed and people found out that I belonged to a gay synagogue, I could have lost my job.
In 1992?
In 1992, still, she was doing that. And we have in the Beit Mishpacha archive membership rolls from the 70s and 80s where there are no addresses, it's mostly just first names, and these people who wanted to come and be a part of an accepting synagogue, even in being a member there, they risked everything. And so ordinary pieces of paper like that can talk about the painful history that these people had to experience in wanting to be part of a Jewish community. Part of why Beit Mishpacha was founded is because these people did not find other institutions to be accepting spaces. And so we look at some of the other D.C. area synagogues and organizations and how sort of some have changed over time, others not as much.
How has the membership, the enrollment in Beit Mishpacha changed as, I mean, hopefully other synagogues in the area have become more accepting?
That's sort of the complicated part of this all is as other congregations have become more accepting, a lot of younger LGBT people who want to affiliate with the synagogue can find community in other synagogues. And so Beit Mishpacha still exists. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. But they are navigating that complicated fact. I mean, I belong to a conservative synagogue here in Washington, and my first and largest group of LGBT friends, period, that I made in Washington, I made through my conservative synagogue. Growing up in Kansas City in a conservative synagogue, never in a million years would I have imagined that. But the dynamics are changing, and there's a common struggle that people talk about in the LGBT community, right? Assimilation has its downsides. But I will also say it's not equal, right? I'm a cisgender white gay man. I have a lot of privilege in that identity, and not everyone in the LGBT community still today is accepted or feels accepted in synagogue spaces. And so when one walks through the door, one needs to hold the door open for other people, and that fight absolutely continues, as does the struggle.
There's fight and there's struggle represented in this exhibit, but there's also fun and whimsy.
And then under a sparkling disco ball, we have a mannequin in a purple floor-length sequence gown, a sort of 1960s style wig, cat eye glasses, and an over-the-top costume jewelry, big sparkly faux diamond earrings and necklace. These all belonged to Washington's Jewish drag queen Esther Goldberg, who was probably in the late 90s and early 2000s among the most popular drag queens in Washington, D.C. She was so popular that she was in 2003 on the cover of the style section of the Washington Post in the very dress that we have here. She had a residency at JR's Bar, a gay bar that still exists here in Washington in the historic gay neighborhood DuPont Circle. And she had a weekly sort of comedy performance slash show that was a spin on Family Feud called Fagala Feud that was so popular that we have a photograph here of Esther up on the balcony during one of her weekly Fagala Feud shows with then members of Congress Barney Frank and Tammy Baldwin, now Senator Tammy Baldwin, who participated in Fagala Feud. We found out about this story, and then I started doing some internet sleuthing. Esther Goldberg was also known as the man Michael Arrington, who played Esther for a number of years. And I found Michael on Instagram. He's living a fabulous life in Los Angeles. And I reached out to him and I said, I found this Esther Goldberg. Is this you? And he goes, of course I'm Esther Goldberg. Who else would be Esther Goldberg? And we had one of the most incredible, bizarre, funny Zoom conversations ever. I convinced him to loan us the outfit, and we were able to include drag in our LGBT Jews exhibition.
So, but Esther Goldberg is no more.
Esther has retired, but you'll notice Esther's name is spelled E-S-T-E-R. The H is missing, and we asked about that, and he said, well, if Barbara can take an A out of her name, I can take an H out of mine. So, I thought that was quintessential.
Around the next corner is a pair of sofas and side tables that hold two old-fashioned rotary phones. There's a sign reading, to listen to an oral history clip, dial a number. Can you show me how to do this?
So there's a directory, and so you just pick a story. So like,
let's do lesbian book clubs and potlucks.
Right.
Okay. So, if you picking up the phone,
and you dial 29.
When you make enough friends and you meet people through friends.
Turns out there are several alive generations of people who have never seen or used a rotary phone before. In the first week of the exhibit, someone broke one because they couldn't figure out how to use it.
And they were trying to punch the keys or something.
Yep. So that was an error on our part. But it's also been fun watching multiple generations who come here together sort of joke about the rotary phone. But it allowed us to bring those voices directly into the exhibit and not just have sort of the quotes on the wall, but people could listen to them.
Yeah, and it gives you the sense of going back in time also. Listening just through this rotary phone. That's so cool. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so let's see. Evelyn Beck, pressure to lead a traditional heterosexual life, 31. So I've got to dial in.
I started to teach that when I grew up, so it was in the 50s, it was a time of the most pressing pressure upon women to go back into the home and to live a heterosexual traditional life.
Larry Neff.
I remember when I was still in college, we used to go down to Georgetown to go into bars and going into Mr. Henry's in Georgetown.
Jocelyn Kaplan, Embracing Diversity.
Well, I think everyone needs to be who they are. Otherwise, they won't be healthy and happy.
I like that sentiment.
There's a lot more to see. in the 21st century kitsch category, there's a baseball hat that says "Hier queer machmir," meaning religiously stringent, from the organization Eshel, which supports queer Orthodox kids, their parents, and communities. There's also a wall of colorful magnetized Hebrew letters where visitors can learn and play with non-binary Hebrew words. At the end of the exhibit, there's a wall where people can leave photos of themselves, adding their own story to this evolving history. After the exhibit closes, the objects will become part of the museum's permanent collection. The Hier Queer Machmir hat will take its place alongside more traditional artifacts, the Torah crowns and mantles, the menorahs and kiddush cups. As curator Sarah Levitt says, there's more to Jewish life than the Judaica and cultural references most people expect from a Jewish museum.
Some people, when you lean in a little too far to nostalgia into that kind of Seinfeld, Knish, whatever rabbit hole, I do think like you kind of lean over so far, you might fall into that and miss so much more about the rich Jewish experience that is so much broader than that, so much more diverse than that, and maybe challenging to people. But that's what I hope for Jewish museums.
That was curator Sarah Levitt. Thanks also to collections curator Jonathan Edelman for the tour. The LGBT Jews in the Federal City exhibit runs at the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. through January 4th. You can learn more at capitoljewishmuseum.org, and you can see photos from the exhibit on our website at jwa.org/canwetalk. Thank you for joining us for Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive. Our team includes Jen Richler and Judith Rosenbaum. Our theme music is by Girls in Trouble. If you love listening to Can We Talk and want to make sure we continue telling stories at the intersection of gender history and Jewish culture, please remember the Jewish Women's Archive when you make your year-end donations. For the month of December, donations will be matched up to $50,000. To contribute, go to jwa.org/donate2025. And thanks. You can find us online at jwa.org/canwetalk. Or wherever you get your podcasts. Jen will be back in 2 weeks with the final episode of our fall season. I'm Nahani Rouse. Until next time.